Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at Carriageworks at the 2018 Festival.
Wow.
How about that, eh?
That's quite an audience.
That's a full hall.
It's amazing.
Where I work, this is bigger than my audience. Shouldn't be mean. Welcome, everybody. Fantastic to see you all here. I have one of those things they call housekeeping to do, and that's to let you know that we are streaming through Live and Loud right across Australia. And if you're listening via the streaming service and you have a question for later on, I can read them off screens if you put it on the hashtag SWF Live and Loud. Welcome, everybody. It's fantastic to see you all here. This is Peter Grester, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to talk about some nasty stuff today, so I hope you're fortified against it. And we're going to talk a lot about what has become a theme for Peter, and that is a sort of a global war on journalism. In the last week, 10 journalists were killed in Afghanistan alone. One was Ahmed Shah, who was a BBC journalist, who was killed in a targeted shooting. To the best of my knowledge, no one's claimed responsibility for that. But 9 other journalists were killed in a single incident, quite deliberately targeted, where a bomb was blasted off in Kabul. TV crews and other journalists turned up to the scene. A suicide bomber who was carrying what appeared to be a TV camera went in close with the other journalists and blew himself up, killing 9 in a single stroke. And that was this week. And it was claimed by Islamic State and was claimed as a deliberate targeting of journalists. They went there to kill journalists. So the war on journalism is real, and it's bloody, and it has real victims. But we're going to talk, and may I just say, it's often invisible. I don't know how many people in here even knew those stories of what was happening this week. I'm sure some of you did. But it's not so widely reported. In some ways, we're fortunate in Peter, because for a moment, the war on journalism became visible and got some publicity and forced us to think a little bit more detailed about it. So let's go to that straight away. And let's take you to the worst of it. What was your worst day of your 400 days in prison?
That's an easy one. The day of our verdict. We had gone through the whole of our arrest and the trial and everything. And anybody who watched it, we knew that people who were watching it recognised there was not a shred of evidence to support the allegations against us. And remember, the charges we were facing were pretty extreme. We were charged with being members of a terrorist organisation, aiding and abetting a terrorist organisation, financing a terrorist organisation, broadcasting false news to undermine national security. They were very serious charges indeed, but there was not a single shred of evidence to back any of that up. And so on the day of the trial, the day of the verdict, we were trying to contain our excitement because we were really convinced that the only rational verdict that the courts could reasonably deliver would be a complete acquittal. We thought that, look, the judges, they've gone through this whole charade because clearly they need to show that they have a judicial process, that they're serious about crime, that they've made the point for journalists. They'd scared the bejesus out of any other journalists that had been working in the region. And they would now show that they had a just justice system and they would release us. We thought, okay, the very worst case scenario, perhaps they'll get us on some sort of confected administrative offence. Maybe, and we'd already spent 6 months in prison at that point and we thought we'd get time served. We thought, the very worst, maybe they'll add on an extra few weeks, maybe a month. So when we got guilty of all charges and sentenced to 7 years in prison, that was a very tough day. That was a very tough moment. Now, I've seen some of the footage from the court immediately after the verdict was delivered, and as anyone who has seen it will know, there was this huge uproar throughout the court. At the time, I didn't hear a thing. My ears were just ringing. It almost felt like I'd been king hit by Mike Tyson, you know, this sort of punch-struck moment where you just feel really disoriented. And 7 years? it was incomprehensible. And 7 years at that point, I mean, now I suppose 7 years doesn't sound like a lot, but boy, oh boy, at the time, the prospect of spending another 7 years in that concrete box was pretty difficult.
Because I think there's a disbelief in us that comes through about what the outcome was and the sheer injustice of it. It's supposed to be a process of justice, and it was plainly, so clearly unjust. But the sense of disbelief had really started with your arrest. And
yes.
Was there a point at which you really felt the deep seriousness of what you were facing?
Anybody that spent time as a correspondent will know, you'll know, that from time to time the authorities will come and knock on your door and take you away because they want to make a point. They want to rattle a few cages. And that's what, well, initially I thought it was a mistake. I thought, look, some bloke had come to us, had misread the room number on the arrest warrant when they knocked on the door of the hotel room. I thought that perhaps that misinterpreted some of what we'd said in our reporting, because one of the things, and this is really important, that we weren't doing anything particularly radical as journalists. I was there covering the Christmas New Year period just for a couple of weeks in Cairo. I didn't know Egypt very well, and again, as you'd know, as a journalist, when you work long enough on a particular story, you start to get a feel for the edges. You start to know how far you can push things before you're going to upset someone. And quite consciously, from time to time, I've been prepared to push those boundaries. I know you have as well, Hugh. And you've been prepared for the consequences. But in Egypt, because I didn't know where those boundaries were, I was playing it with a very straight bat. I was really not doing anything that I thought of as particularly provocative. The government would make a statement. We're in the middle of a political crisis, so the government would make a statement, make a change to the constitution, for example. You'd then go and get the opposition to talk, and then you'd find an analyst to make sense of it all. It's journalism 101. And so when the knock came, I thought they've made a mistake, misunderstood what we've done, until we were confronted with the charges. And that's the very serious terrorism allegations that I just mentioned. And that's when I realized that this is a much bigger deal than we ever imagined.
It's a wonderful account. It's a wonderful prison diary in some ways, quite apart from the other themes that you bring out. And you're incredibly honest about the dynamic in jail that develops between Mohamed Fahmy and Baha Mohamed, your two colleagues from Al Jazeera, that it wasn't always a comfortable arrangement.
No. Fahmy, in particular, Fahmy and I are two very different characters. We have very different worldviews. And I've got a lot of respect for both of those guys. They're both extraordinary people, and I know them with an intimacy that I probably didn't really want at the beginning of this. But you spend 23 hours a day in a concrete box with someone for 6 months, and you get to know and understand them pretty well, particularly under pressure. And there's nothing like pressure to bring out the true character of someone. And Fahmy and I have very different understandings of the world. Now, that's not to say that I don't care very deeply about Fahmy. And Fahmy said to me once, he said, look, you know, this experience has made us like brothers. And it's true that we've got this bond, this connection. We have, that will always be in our DNA, that experience has really brought us together. But I said to him, look, that's true, Fahmy, we are like brothers. But you know what they say, you can choose your friends, but you can't choose your family.
Yeah, and there's a point there also where Baha becomes very despondent and becomes convinced, in fact, he begins a hunger strike.
Yeah.
And there's a pressure for you to join in the hunger strike, and there are others in the prisons who are very keen to effect a hunger strike. And you've got no illusions about hunger strike is two words, but the reality of it is the real danger of threat to your own health.
And a hunger strike, if you're serious about it, a hunger strike is one-way street. And it either leads you out, well, it leads you out of that situation, either walking out to freedom or in a box. And you can't begin that process unless you're prepared to finish it in a box. And I don't say this flippantly. You know, this is it's really one of those things that you have to come to terms with, because if you start a hunger strike and then you back off and you say, oh, it's okay, then you've fired that bolt. You can never use that again. And people, your own supporters lose faith in you, the people who are holding you understand that you do have limits, that they do have you under control, that you are prepared to give up. And so you've got to be prepared to take it to its logical conclusion. You cannot stop eating. This is what, and you know, when you see, I remember the story of Bobby Sands, the IRA prisoner who started a hunger strike and he died. And we were at a point, I'd had a lot of conversations with a lot of other political prisoners, including one guy, an extraordinary character called Alaa Abdel Fattah, who had been in and out of Egyptian prisons under every regime from Hosni Mubarak through. He'd been in and out of prison 5 times and he's still there to this day. And I was talking to him early on about hunger strikes, and he was saying that you have to have a very clear strategy around it, that you need to have a communication strategy, you need to have a plan, you need to have a purpose, needs to be achievable. You need to have a goal that's achievable, whether it's freedom, if that's what you're after, or some other concession that you can get out of the authorities. It needs to be achievable, and you need to have the moral high ground. And at the time that the others were wanting to strike, and Behar in particular, we had none of those things. But they were also feeling so frustrated, so angry. They felt that the process itself wasn't going anywhere. It wasn't moving fast enough. And Behar in particular, who had a wife and children, and a newborn baby too, a baby that was born while we were in prison, he felt that he had to do something to prove that he had the mettle and to inspire his supporters. And we came within a whisker of starting that hunger strike.
Well, he stopped eating.
He actually stopped eating, that's right. And he stopped eating about 5 days before we actually had a chance to make it public. When we had a visit from our families and we were going to announce it and slip them a letter that they would then go away and publish. And on the day of the visit, we actually had news that the Court of Cassation had finally agreed to hear our case. And Behar, that was the thing that allowed Behar to back off the strike.
I'm conscious also that solidarity is so vital under these conditions, and yet you had, and this is one of the really human elements of the book, is that there wasn't complete solidarity. So Fahmy had his own ideas about how to play it, and he was getting his own lawyers and so on. And Behar had given a statement, and you didn't know what was in the statement. And Fahmy in particular was very deeply speculative about what it might be in that statement, and felt that one of the three of you had basically sold you out, so that you were sitting there in a cell, not quite knowing what was going on, and yet...
And this was one of the real challenges. And let's go and tackle Fahmy's issues first. And Fahmy saw things as politics. He felt that we are in prison because of politics between Egypt and Qatar, and therefore we needed to play that political game. And he felt that he knew and understood Egyptian politics in a way that nobody else did, and certainly I didn't, and I had to confess that I didn't see it, that I didn't understand Egyptian politics. And Fahmy felt that because of that, he needed to take charge and you know, damn the torpedoes, whatever we felt that he was going to go and push that. I felt at the time that, look, even if this is about politics, we can't afford to play that game because we've got no capacity to see and understand what's going on. And even if we do, we've got no capacity really to control the narrative, to actually play the politics. And we needed, if we wanted to get out, to make it very clear that this wasn't about politics, but about principle. And I still feel that. That wasn't a cynical decision, by the way. I absolutely feel 100% convinced that this was about an attack on press freedom. But we needed to at least maintain some kind of sense of common purpose, because we also knew that if we allowed that sense of solidarity to crumble, again, the rest of the world would start to question what was going on with us. Now, Fahmy had said that Baher had made a statement. We'd all made separate statements to the prosecutor under interrogation. And Fahmy had other back channels, apparently. And he was telling us some of the things that Baher had allegedly said, which supposedly made up a lot of the substance of the allegations against us, including the idea that I would somehow bring in bags of cash for the Muslim Brotherhood. Baher insisted that he'd never made any of those statements, and that if they were, if the statement that was on the record was recorded, that it wasn't something that it had been substantially changed or altered. It's possible that somewhere along the line there was misinterpretation. I did bring in cash. As you know, you often in those countries you have to work with cash, particularly if you're paying your translators and fixers and so on. And we were paying, I brought in a bit of extra money for the bureau, and the bureau would occasionally buy freelance pictures from guys, and those freelancers were guys that would work in Muslim Brotherhood, cover Muslim Brotherhood demonstrations, and so by definition they were probably members of the Brotherhood, and therefore you could have conceivably come to the conclusion, if you sort of put all of those pieces together, with the idea that somehow I was bringing in money to finance the Brotherhood. In any event, we're stuck in this situation where Fahmy wants to bring out that statement, publicly decry the statement when the statement had never been introduced in court, and I felt that you just can't go that route, because what you do is present evidence against yourself
to try to refute it.
And it made no sense at all. And so there was just I can't begin to tell you how much stress that put us under. We came so close to physical blows on a number of occasions. And in a concrete box, in a pressure cooker, there is nowhere for that anger to go. You have to bear down and grit it out, or talk it out, and if you can't talk it out, then somehow you have to allow that to diffuse, because otherwise it just explodes. And like I said, in a concrete box, it's like throwing a grenade inside a tank. The bits of shrapnel just rattle around and chew up everything inside.
Yeah. There's a moment in this where there's a kind of an epiphany for you, and it's triggered by a book. Mm. We're at a writer's festival, let's talk books. What was the book, and why did it suddenly change your thinking about your situation?
It took a long time for us to get books in reading material. For the first 3 months or so, the authorities refused to give us anything. It was access to any books or writing material, reading material. Finally, they allowed us some books in, and one of the books that they allowed through was a fantastic book by a guy called Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning. Hands up, I can hear a murmur through the crowd. Yeah, there are quite a few hands popping up there. In a world of pop psychology books, of self-help books, of motivational books, Frankl stands out as a book that was written with extraordinary integrity by a man who knows what he's talking about. Frankl was a survivor of the Holocaust. He made it through three of the Nazi camps, including Auschwitz, and he was a psychiatrist to begin with. And as a survivor, what he did was to write a book that tried to understand the difference between those that survived and those that did not. And apart from the randomness of the camps, Frankl realized that it had nothing to do with physical fitness and all about your mental approach. And Frankl quoted Nietzsche in that he said that he who has a why can bear any how. As long as you have a purpose for the suffering that you're going through, you can put up with just about anything. And the purpose is not necessarily God, as in the abstract. It needs to be something much more tangible, whether it's a family member, a loved one, or a cause. And all of a sudden, on reading that, I understood that what we were going through was a struggle for press freedom. Fundamentally, all of the politics aside, in the absence of evidence of any wrongdoing, the only reason that we could possibly be in prison in those circumstances was because the authorities wanted to silence the press. And all of a sudden, I became no longer a victim, because this wasn't about anything we had done. This was about what we had come to represent. And in that situation, I was no longer a victim. I was a representative, not just of me and my colleagues, but I kind of had this mental image of sometimes turning around and seeing this vast sort of column of other journalists. And then behind those journalists, all the people that depended on us for information about the world around them, all stretched out behind me. And I felt, okay, this is why we're here. And that changed, for me, that changed the psychology 180 degrees. It made me realize, it gave me so much strength to be able to get through. And that's really when I understood what Frankl was meaning.
It made you revisit other events in your life, not in a broad sense about you were looking at the attacks on journalism globally, but also in quite an intimate case. You'd had the appalling, horrifying experience in Somalia in 2005, I think it was, where your producer, Kate Payton, was shot and fatally wounded.
Yes.
There's a terribly moving section in there where the last words that she seems to say is, "I'm scared," just before an anaesthetist comes to her and she doesn't recover from that anaesthetic. But you looked at that initially at the time, and for some time afterwards you thought it was one of those random events that happens in a place like Mogadishu, but you revisited it.
Yeah, I put in some calls, and I started to think a lot more about it, and I started to ask, through the researching for the book in fact, I was starting to ask around other people who were there at the time. So let me just fill in very quickly on the backstory. Somalia had been a country in utter anarchy since the early 1990s up until the mid-2000s. And finally, the government had been in exile in Kenya, in Nairobi, and finally they felt that it was possibly safe enough, things had stabilised enough for the government to move back, to relocate back to Mogadishu. And we were in Mogadishu doing a whole series of stories around that environment that they were going to return to try and make clear what it was that what the country had become in the absence of government and press coverage for almost a decade. And there was another group of journalists that were doing something similar just before us. And what had happened was that I discovered that one of the journalists had gone to meet the Islamic Courts Union, and she interviewed Sheikh Sharif Sheikh Hassan, the head of the ICU at the time. And there was another couple of characters in there in that interview. Now, apparently it seemed to go okay, but after the interview, she got wind through her translator that a contract had been issued for a journalist, that there'd been orders to kill. And they kept their profile low and they left soon after. But what they had been doing was going routinely to the Sahafi Hotel, a white woman and a photographer, white female journalist and a photographer. And we went back the day after they had left and did exactly the same thing. That we went in as a white female journalist and a male, white male photographer into the Sahafi Hotel. And it was as we were coming out that someone drove by and took a shot that hit Kate in the back. And although we don't know, the guy that supposedly issued the contract was killed in an American drone strike some years later, all of the circumstantial evidence suggests that we took a bullet that was intended for Alex.
So it was mistaken identity, but at the same time, the purpose was the same.
But the purpose was the same. The purpose, again, was to stop journalists from doing their work, from covering the story. And this was really important because it made me understand, made me see what had happened to us in Egypt, but also what a lot of my own career, the trajectory of my own career, from Afghanistan in 1995 back to Afghanistan in 2001, all the way through to the present. It made me see things in a context that I hadn't seen before. That what I come to see as a series of random events all of a sudden started to take on a pattern. Now, I'm very aware of the kind of tendency for humans to sort of see patterns where there are none. But in this case, I think that there's something really fundamentally important to this pattern, and it's the way that journalists have become targets in ways that we never were before, particularly by Islamic, from both sides of the conflict. Talk about 95, Afghanistan?
Sure.
95 in Afghanistan, we used to cross the front lines all the time. Civil war in place, we recognized not just for our professional integrity, but also for our own professional safety, I needed to go and cross the front lines. I knew that at some point you spend time on the lines, someone on the other side is going to see a white, shaved, clean-shaven male over in the other trenches in his sights, he's going to see me in his rifle sights, and if he sees me as the enemy, he's going to pull the trigger without having a second thought. And so both sides needed to understand that we were not the enemy, that we had a legitimate role to play. So we would go and cross the front lines. Whenever the front lines were safe enough, were stable enough, we would drive across. And the people we would go and see on the other side in 1995 were the Taliban. We sat down and drank tea with them, endless cups of tea, and spoke to them. They didn't necessarily like us or understand our theology, but we respected one another and we had those conversations. 2001, and governments were also encouraging us to cross the front lines because, again, what they needed was an understanding of the story, understanding of what was taking place, an understanding of what the thinking of the Taliban was. Fast forward to 2001, we saw a convoy of journalists driving up from Sarabi, in the east of Afghanistan, to Kabul. And the convoy included four journalists, including a wonderful Italian journalist, a very good friend of mine, Maria Grazia Catulli, and the Australian cameraman, Harry Burton, who worked for Reuters. I don't know if you ever knew Harry.
I didn't know, but I remember the story very well. Yeah.
The Taliban stopped the convoy. They let everybody go. They pulled these journalists out. They dragged them into the hills outside, the dusty hills, and emptied the magazines of their Kalashnikovs into them. And they were captured eventually and tried, and in the trial they acknowledged that they'd done it, but they also said that they're under orders from the Taliban leadership to go after journalists. Same with governments. All of a sudden we see the Americans dropping a bomb on the Al Jazeera bureau in Kabul. A very clear message.
Not their only one, was it? Because they've dropped bombs on journalist outlets in Belgrade during the Kosovo conflict. They've done it in Afghanistan more than once. They've done it in Iraq, where they've taken
out... Iraq, yes, exactly. Taken out several times, they've taken out journalists. And these are situations, one or two you can forgive as accidents, as often happens. But in both in Kabul and in Baghdad, the journalist officers have been absolutely clearly marked. The coordinates have been given to the American government, the military, so they know where those buildings are. And because the journalists that were in Baghdad were mindful of the bombing that took place in Kabul, they had a huge sign around it saying media around the building. And still, they fired a couple of tank rounds.
So it's hard to blame Islamic State, the Taliban, even Sisi, for seeing journalists as enemy journalists, which is kind of an interesting concept when the United States sees journalists
well,
as enemy.
Yeah, and let me explain why. It's because I think what's happened, and this is a really fundamental point, and it's not an abstract one. In wars prior to 9/11, a lot of the wars prior to 9/11, they were wars over tangible things, things you could point to, whether it's land or water or ethnicity. Even sectarian affiliation is a thing that you can lay your hands on. And in those kinds of conflicts, journalists are observers. We're not participants. Inconvenient observers, yes, often, particularly when someone wants to try and hide an atrocity that they don't want exposed, and that's where you become targeted. But generally, as an industry, we were not seen as participants. But what happened in 9/11 was that we saw the conflict turned into a conflict over ideas. And in that war for ideas, the space where ideas are transmitted becomes, by definition, a part of the battle space. And so journalists become targets because we are vectors for those ideas. And George W. Bush said in his special joint session before, in front of Congress, special joint session of Congress after 9/11, he stood up and he said, in this war, you are either with us or you're with the terrorists. It was a binary choice. Now, at face value, that seems fine. It's understandable because it was such an atrocious attack. But the implication for journalists was that if you did your job and you crossed the line and you tried to interrogate what the extremists were thinking, what it was that drove Al-Qaeda and Islamic State to carry out the kinds of atrocities, if you did that, then you were accused of broadcasting or promoting terrorist ideology. That's what happened with Al Jazeera. They went and got the one interview that I would wager every journalist in the world would have wanted immediately after 9/11, and that was with Osama bin Laden. Now, Al Jazeera was accused of promoting terrorist ideology, of being a mouthpiece for the terrorists, and guess what happened? A bomb landed on the bureau. Now, again, whatever you think of the rights and wrongs of giving a voice to the extremists, if you run a country that is founded on the liberal principles of freedom of speech, of freedom of expression, the free flow of ideas, and above all, the freedom of the press, you can't then start dropping bombs on the press.
And you quote John Stuart Mill there with the very obvious and traditional liberal view that it is right to hear from your enemies so that ideas can be tested.
And as an academic, I'm an academic at the University of Queensland, professor of journalism, and in that environment, the thing that they keep talking about is the contest of ideas. The whole idea of academia is to hold up an idea and then subject it to attack. And the longer that idea stands up, the more confident you can be that the idea is valid. If the idea starts to crumble under attack, then you know it's flawed and you need to throw it out and start again. So the healthiest way of coming up with a system and a set of ideas and values that work is by exposing it to contrary ideas, exposing them to attack. Now, I recognize that's idealistic, but it's a principle that's founded some of the safest, most stable and prosperous places on the planet, that we have this kind of contest of ideas. And if you then start ring-fencing the ideas that you can and can't promote, then all of a sudden you start allowing bad ideas to float to the surface and stay there.
There's a great deal, let's bring the whole issues back home in a sense, because there's a great deal of illiberalism in the way in which the journalism is treated now, the number of laws that have been passed since 9/11, the consequences for free speech and certainly for a free press in Australia, the potential criminalisation of journalists for doing their jobs, and certainly the criminalisation and the jailing of people who, in good faith, produce, maybe whistleblowers who produce documents that are embarrassing, merely embarrassing to governments, and they face jail terms. Give us your assessment as to where Australia is and the dangers that we currently face.
This is really key. I mean, what's happened since 9/11 is that we've seen a whole paradigm build up around the war on terror. A very good friend of mine rather dryly quipped that we've got a war on an abstract noun. Which is true. When you think about it, it's indefinable. You cannot get your hands on it. You can't ever win this war. You can't ever declare victory in the war on terror, because it's such a difficult abstract concept, and it can be defined in any ways that anybody wants it to mean. What was happening in Egypt was that the government was defining terrorism, and under the law, terrorism is anything that challenged or threatened the integrity of the state, so that if you marched down the street in a protest against the government or you disrupted a civil servant from his duties, you could be charged with an act of terror. What we're seeing here is that narrative also take hold, where the governments have been using the threat of terrorism to introduce all sorts of pieces of draconian legislation which chip away at some of the fundamental elements of the way our democracy has worked and worked so successfully. You mentioned the data retention legislation. For those of you that don't know, You might recall there was a hue and cry a few years ago around the metadata bill, in which the government has the authority, a whole host of government agencies, not just the security services, they have the capacity to investigate the metadata of any Australian. Metadata is, of course, the details of who you communicate with, either through your phone or email or online, the addresses of the websites that you go to, the amount of time you go to, or the data, the location data on your cell phone, all of that stuff. It doesn't include the contents of your messages, but you don't really need the contents if you have all of those connections in place. And the government said, look, we need this for security service, for security purposes. We need to be able to disrupt terrorists from their activities. And okay, that makes sense, and no Australian is really going to want to give terrorists free rein to operate. And there was also a bit of hue and cry from journalists who said, hang on a tick, you can't investigate our metadata because we need to protect our sources. And so the government said, okay, what we will do is set up secret courts where we will allow hearings to take place into whether or not we ought to give a warrant to investigate a journalist's metadata, except the people who are supposed to represent the journalists are never allowed to speak to the journalists. They're called public interest advocates. They have to kind of guess at what it is that the journalist is covering and then try and make a case. But let's set that to one side. There is no protection for the sources that you're investigating, so, or that you're talking to. So if you, I don't know, if you're interested in, say, the conditions on the offshore detention centres and you start speaking to employees in those offshore detention centres, the government decides that this is a national security issue, then they don't have to look at your metadata. They can just simply go and look at the data of those employees.
Now, and there's no public interest.
No public interest defence.
Defence.
No. Yeah. Well, there's no defence. You don't need to make a case for it. You just go and start digging around for it. Now, as I said earlier, this was supposed to be a piece of national security legislation. But guess what? The metadata was used to investigate the sources of leaks about the conditions on Manus and Nauru. Now, whatever your thoughts are about the rights and wrongs of the offshore detention policy, I don't think you can justify an investigation into those sources on national security grounds. That was a political case. Those leaks were politically embarrassing. And so what we've seen happening is the government using that legislation, national security legislation, to go after the sources of leaks that are politically embarrassing. That's a problem. And what's more troubling is that the chilling effect is that sources won't bother coming to us as journalists any longer because they know that they're vulnerable. I was talking to one of the lead counsels for The Australian just a couple of days ago. 2 days ago was World Press Freedom Day, and I was at an event where News Limited's counsel was talking, and he was saying that if he's asked to legal a particular story, to give a legal opinion on a story, and a journalist comes with a source, the first thing he says is, how did you get this document? And if the journalist says, I got it on email, he says, look, I'm sorry, we can't touch it because we can't protect our source. And remember that our system of democracy depends on our capacity to hold governments to account and civil servants to account. I'm not saying that we should have free rein to dig around the entrails of every corner of government. There has to be an issue around national security. But we have systems in place, like a very well-established warrant system that has done a pretty good job so far. We ought to be protecting whistleblowers and celebrating whistleblowers rather than making it a criminal offence.
Because the critical matter, people might have seen the film The Post, that was a revisiting of the Pentagon Papers case, where the US government went all the way to the Supreme Court to try to stop initially the New York Times and the Washington Post releasing these documents, which were essentially demonstrating that for years and years and years, the US government had persisted with the war in Vietnam when its own internal evidence, very solidly found internal evidence, was that the war was unwinnable and they could only lose. So into that Charnel House, they were sending more and more American kids and killing more and more Vietnamese. And the effort went all the way to the Supreme Court, essentially to save a government from political embarrassment. There is no higher case. And we're seeing that here.
We are seeing that here. And let's get back to that fundamental problem that this underpins the way our democracy has worked. It's not always pretty. It's not always especially edifying. I completely understand that people can be pretty disgusted by the way the media works, but it works. It has worked. There's a reason why our country is one of the most stable, peaceful, and prosperous places on the planet. It's been that way for 200 years, and that's because we've had a robust, free press. It's one of the fundamental pillars of the system. So it seems to me slightly perverse that in trying to protect ourselves from terrorism, we're actually chipping away at one of the pillars of the system that's made it so effective. I think you want to get to questions.
Probably.
But there's just one thing I want to talk about very briefly, and this is an area called the grey zone. Our democracy depends on what one organisation has called the grey zone, and that's the space that we have for debate, for conversation. It allows us to sit in a forum like this and throw opinions and ideas around and not wind up in a punch-up, not have the stormtroopers come in and drag anybody who disagrees with the government out and throw them in prison. That grey zone is fundamental to the way a democracy works. And this organisation that uses the term, that coined the term, wasn't any kind of democracy group, it wasn't Amnesty International, it was Islamic State. They wrote a piece called The Destruction of the Grey Zone. It was on the front cover of their online magazine called Dabiq. And they said that they cannot, that Islamic society, the Islamists, the extremists, cannot operate in a place with that grey zone. They're trying to destroy it. And they quoted one man in support of the grey zone, in support of their campaign to destroy the grey zone, rather, and that was George W. Bush, and when he said, "You are either with us or you're with the terrorists," a binary choice. And that, I think, is what we need to remind ourselves of, that we need to protect the integrity of that grey zone, the space that we can all have to talk and disagree and understand what's being done in our names.
Well, let's go to the grey zone. If you have a question, there are microphones dotted around. People are so quickly on their feet, I was going to sneak in one more of my own.
Yes, thanks for the conversation. My name is Kate Harris. And just in regards to man's search for meaning, I was wondering if you requested that or if the prison gave it as a kind of life raft against despair. And were you the only one of the three of you to read it?
It's a wonderful question. Actually, it was neither of those things. It was my family was able to bring in a number of books, and they gave them to the prison authorities, and they'd have a look through them and decide whether or not to allow us to read them, and that's how it got through. They brought in that book with a number of others, and we all read the book, and it had a profound meaning for all of us. Although, as in the case with a lot of these kinds of books, each person takes away something different. And I think that's one of the beauties of a really rich book. You know it's a great book when everybody has something special that when it speaks to them in a particular way.
Thank you for the question. Up here.
Oh, hi. I'm Susie Miller, playwright. I'm just really wanting to know what now for Peter. That grey zone, how do you go back out into the world as a foreign correspondent and be able to engage in that dialogue?
Yeah, good, really good question. It's one of the reasons why I'm an academic now. look, actually, there's a practical problem for me. I'm still technically a convicted terrorist, and I still have an outstanding prison sentence to serve in Egypt. They want me back. And that makes travel internationally very difficult for two reasons. First of all, any country that has an extradition treaty with Egypt is technically a problem, and that means the whole of the Middle East, the whole of the African Union, all sorts of places where I've spent most of my professional life in. And so I need to be very careful, and going back into that old world is just a non-starter. And the second problem is, hands up those of you who've tried to get into the United States as a convicted terrorist. It's not easy. It raises its own challenges. We can do it, but boy, oh boy, there's a lot of paperwork involved. So that's one of the reasons why I'm now officially UNESCO Chair in Journalism and Communications at the University of Queensland, and that gives me the chance both to help shape some of the thinking and of the next generation of journalists, but it also gives me space, the opportunity to do a lot of research around these questions, and we're starting a new organisation called the Alliance for Journalist Freedom, which will use the university, will work with the university to develop a research agenda and come up with really solid empirical research into some of these really big questions about the impact of legislation, about the relationship of government to media. And then the AJF will use that research into public debate. But I'm also, God, I find it hard to give up my old life. and so I'm still doing some journalism projects as well. We just did a film called Monash and Me, which is a very unconventional. and I'd like to do more of that as well, so a bit of a mix.
I'm going to take a question from offline in just a moment, but I'm pointing to a monitor, but you first, sir.
As a convicted terrorist, how do you view Mr. Dutton's department wanting to now extend the reach of the Signals Directorate into domestic affairs? There's apparently a real rift in Cabinet about this. That it really seems a very serious issue, because the previous legislation, you know, which required a hearing, the first thing that happened was one of the people in the police were doing it without a warrant.
Look, this is one of the first principles that has underpinned our system of democracy. And again, I don't want to sound patronising, but we have a very clear separation of the judiciary from government. We have a system of oversight, of checks and balances, and the warrant system is designed to protect us. In a democracy, we have a balance between the authority of the state and the rights of the individual. And that line has been very clearly defined and protected, particularly through the warrant system. And it's served us very well until now. And I'm very concerned that what we're doing is eroding that barrier and allowing the government to intrude on the private space of individuals. Now, again, I'm not saying that the government should have no right to investigate. Clearly, there is a need for it. But not without a warrant. I don't understand why we have to upend that system. And so I am very concerned about it because of the implications that has on public debate, on public discussion, on freedom of the press, freedom of speech, freedom of association. And we have to be very clear about where the line is and the purpose of that line. And I think we sometimes lose sight of that. And this is one of the things that goes back to when we use national security as a cover, it seems to give a lot of the politicians a lot of space to extend their reach, and I think that's a problem.
We've got an audience as well as this one. We've got a virtual audience out there who are listening to this and watching it through the streaming live and local service. And a question has come in from Amy saying, you've spoken about the dangers of reporting from conflict zones. What, if anything, can be done to make that work safer?
Oh, boy, I wish I had an answer for that.
Didn't work in Kabul this week.
Didn't work in Kabul this week, no. And it doesn't matter how much training you have and how many flak jacket, you know, how solid your flak jacket is. If someone walks in to a bunch of journalists and detonates a suicide bomb, it's very difficult to survive. The problem is recent years, although the numbers at the moment this year are very bad, particularly because of that one incident, recent years the numbers have started to tail off of journalists killed. We're a record for the number of journalists in prison, 262 as of December last year. But the numbers in the last couple of years of those murdered are down a little bit, and I've got a Somali friend and colleague who says that's not because the killers of journalists have understood the errors of their ways and decided to repent. It's because journalists have got the message that there are some stories that are just too dangerous to go and cover. That is not the substance of Amy's question. The question is, how do we make it safe enough for journalists to continue that kind of vital work? There are obvious issues around training of journalists, equipping journalists with the right kind of technical equipment, whether it's flak jackets, communications gear, tracking gear, and so on, whether it's about supporting journalists so that when things go wrong, there's enough institutional backing. The problem at the moment is that we're allowing freelancers to work in places where only staffers would have gone before. And if a freelancer gets caught, gets killed, gets kidnapped, A lot of news organisations are just holding their hands up saying, well, it's not our problem, he's not one of our staffers, it's a freelance. That's a problem. But that still doesn't get to the fundamental issue of why people feel the need, why the extremists feel the need, and governments feel the need to come after journalists in the first place. And I don't have an easy answer for that. The answer that I'm offering today, the one that I keep talking about, is that we need to understand and recognise and respect the role of journalists. But frankly, after this week's bomb attack, that feels like a pretty hollow answer. I just don't know what to say.
I'm afraid for those who are waiting with questions, I'm going to have to frustrate you because we are out of time. Peter will be available, I think, to sign some books if you'd like that. I have a book out. I'll sign your book as well. I'll sign his book. I might get more signatures done. Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Peter Grester.